Today on the 21st Show, sometimes it can seem like scammers, fraudsters, and fake news are all around us, from Theranos and FTX to supposed public health analysis that betrays a serious misunderstanding of the science. We might think we're too sophisticated for that, but a pair of psychologists, including Daniel Simons of the University of Illinois, say we are all vulnerable.
When we're under time pressure, when we're being pushed, when we have to take a quick decision, when we're afraid or really hopeful, we might not take the time to remain uncertain. We might form an opinion, pass it along, without taking the time to say, is that really true?
That said, there are habits of mind we can cultivate to arm ourselves against getting taken in. Simon's new book is Nobody's Fool, and we'll talk about it for the hour. I'm Brian Mackey, and this is The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Sometimes it can seem like fraud and deception are all around us. From the telemarketing calls we all get asking for donations to the Policeman's Fund, to the billion-dollar deceptions that make headlines around the world.
Fixture on Wall Street, Bernie Madoff, 70 years old, arrested by the FBI.
Theranos founder Elizabeth Holmes, once a rising star in the tech startup world, now convicted criminal facing 11 years in prison for defrauding investors.
This morning we unsealed an 8-count indictment charging Samuel Bankman-Fried, FTX's founder, with a series of interrelated fraud schemes that contributed to FTX's collapse.
These frauds persist because, well, frankly, because they work. There are aspects of human psychology that make us vulnerable to these scams. Even those of us who think we know better can, in the right circumstances, get taken in. But it doesn't have to be that way. There are habits of mind we can use to make us less vulnerable to scammers. And all that is the subject of a new book called Nobody's Fool: Why We Get Taken In and What We Can Do About It. It's by Daniel Simons and Christopher Chabris. They are two psychologists who've been collaborating for years. Simons is a professor of psychology at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, where he heads the Visual Cognition Laboratory. He also has appointments in advertising and business. I spoke with Simons back in July. We're revisiting that conversation again today because this Friday, Simons will be giving a big public talk about some of these topics. It's called the Lanier Lecture. It's at 4 p.m. on Friday at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. We'll have more details on our website if you want to try and get there yourself. Dan Simons, welcome to the 21st Show. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, you divide the book largely into habits and hooks. That's habits of thought, the how and why of how our brains work. And then the second half of the book goes through information hooks, right? These are kind of candy ideas intended to short-circuit our skepticism. So let's start, as you do in the book, with the idea of truth bias. What is that?
Yeah, so truth bias is the idea that when we first encounter some information, any information, we tend to sort of tag it as true, and only with effort or time do we maybe reconsider it or think about it as uncertain or maybe wrong, right? So take one simple example. When we logged onto Zoom today, I told you that I was Dan Simons. You assumed that that was true and there was really no reason to counter it. And that's what we need to do for most of our interactions in our daily life, right? We have to assume that other people are being honest with us. We can't constantly checking every aspect of everything we encounter. We have to assume that the world is basically the way we see it, right? And that's, for the most part, a really good thing. It allows us to interact with other people in, you know, pleasant ways. It allows us to get by in the world. We don't have to constantly check whether the floor is solid with each step we take. We just assume that it's true. Then the downside of that is when we're under time pressure, when we're being pushed, when we have to take a quick decision, when we're afraid or really hopeful, we might not take the time to remain uncertain. We might form an opinion, believe something, accept something, pass it along without taking the time to say, is that really true? And that's when we are subject to deception. So this truth bias that we have is sort of the precursor, the thing that has to be in place for almost every kind of deception to function.
What's the evolutionary basis? Why is this a good thing for us to have this truth bias?
Well, I mean, you can think of it as a good thing, and this is true for almost all of the habits and hooks we talk about in the book, that the vast majority of the time, nobody's trying to con us, right? We're not being deceived, at least not in a big way, much of the time. Most of interactions are honest. Most people aren't out to get us. So most of what we do in our daily lives depends on having a shared assumption that the world is the way it is, right? And that people aren't going to try and pull one over on us. So it makes sense that this would work the vast majority of the time. And even though we've written a whole book about the mechanisms of deception, deception isn't all that common, right? And at least in a big way, there's little deception here and there. There's unintentional deception. We sometimes pass along things that we shouldn't and end up deceiving other people without intending to. But in the big picture, right, we're not likely to be the victims of a grand con.
Yeah. Bernie Madoff only had so many clients.
That's right. And you know, not all that many of us have the opportunity to invest in fraudulent fine art, right? It's not it's not something that's likely to happen. You know, we're not going to invest in Theranos as individuals, most of us. Now, we might end up falling victim to other kinds of more local cons, small scale deceptions. But those grand cons that last for years, most of us are unlikely to run into those in our lifetime.
You know, you mentioned when we came on the Zoom, you are who you say you are. You look like your photo on the university website.
Yeah, you checked.
And well, I do, because I come at this from the lens of a journalist, right? You have this official biography that says you're a professor of psychology at the U of I. You have these appointments in advertising and business as well. I check that.
Yep.
University records seem to bear that out. Your bio also says you get a bachelor's degree from Carleton College and a doctorate from Cornell. And listeners, I did not call the registrars at Carleton College or Cornell to verify that. So am I making a mistake?
Nope, that's right. And if I were trying to lie to you, would I say that? It's something that's easily verifiable, right? So the fact that you're looking and checking these sorts of things, it's something that journalists are trained to do. It's something that scientists are trained to do, is to question critically, make sure that you're not being misled by a source, right?
Yeah.
That's something you have to verify. Most of us in our daily lives, we don't do that, right? So if somebody tells you, hey, I'll be at the, you know, shopping mall, meet you there at 6, we don't verify that, you know, they are who they say they are. We don't try and check that there actually is a shopping mall. We kind of know these things. We know that they're true. And we assume that they're not lying to us just to get us to go and wait at the shopping mall for them. Right.
Yeah. And when I go to the local burger restaurant here and they tell me that the beef in the burger I'm eating was procured from Ed, who runs a farm in so-and-so small town 20 miles away, I don't really have the capacity to check that.
Yeah. I mean, we can't really be permanent skeptics about every single thing we encounter, right? If you go to the grocery store and the vegetables have a sign on them that says organic, right? You have to take that on faith to some extent, right? You can't go out to the farm where they were produced and monitor to make sure that they never used Roundup, right? That's not, you know, that's not something any of us can do. So there has to be some level of trust. Now, there are cases where you can't trust, right? Let's say you have a severe nut allergy, right? You really can't trust that the person who's telling you what's on the menu knows that they didn't use nuts in any part of it. They have to actually go back to the kitchen and ask the chefs and make sure that there was no nut oil used in anything, or that it wasn't used in the same pans that had nuts. So, you know, when there are big risks, that's when you really want to make sure that you verify, especially when it's really important.
Yeah. And so there's these degrees of skepticism. Overall, your big picture advice in the book is, or at least your starting advice in the book is, accept less, check more, right? You hear something sensational, ask yourself, is that really true? Say more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a general principle, that more often than not, we don't tend to question when we should. And that not tending to question doesn't mean constantly second-guessing everything. It means when it's important, when it matters to you, when the consequences could be bad, could be dire, that's when it pays to just check a little bit more, even if it's just asking, literally just asking one more question, right? Am I making a big mistake here? Or is this really true? So here's a situation that happens to all of us all the time, right? So you're on social media, you're on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or wherever you like to hang out, and somebody posts something that very naturally aligns with what you believe. It's like, yeah, that's exactly right. What do you tend to do with that? You tend to reshare it or like it or retweet it. But those are the cases where when it's exactly what you expect, that it's most likely to fool you, So just stopping for a second, say, okay, before I reshare this, what information would I need to know if this was actually true? And it's amazing how often I will see colleagues and friends reshare something that I actually know to be false because I looked into it, but it perfectly aligns with what everybody expects. It makes it very easy to sort of share it and inadvertently deceive other people, right? Nobody's intending to fool their friends, right? They're intending to share something they think their friends will like. But if you don't stop for that second, say, is that really true? That's all you really need to do. That one little question, it's like, is that really true? And it might trigger you to look a little bit further. And maybe if it triggers you to look a little bit further, you'll just remain uncertain just a little bit longer. And that's not a bad idea.
Yeah, the example you give in the book is a widely shared social media post when President Trump was new to office and he nominated Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court. There was a story that went around that all the other justices unanimously stood up as one and rejected him for the court.
Which, of course, never happens if you think about that, right? Supreme Court justices don't typically talk about nominees for the court at all, let alone unanimously write a letter objecting. And the reality there was that a court from many years ago had cited one of Gorsuch's decisions and overturned some much earlier decision, which happens all the time, right? A lower court decision is overturned for other reasons at a higher level. And it wasn't even a statement about anything having to do with Gorsuch's nomination. It was a totally different sort of situation. And in that case, the Supreme Court happened to have been unanimous in that overturning of some earlier verdict, right, earlier ruling. What's interesting about a lot of these sorts of cases of social media misinformation is that they have a germ of truth, right? There's something that they're latching onto, and then it just gets distorted out of all whack.
This reminds me of the anecdote you use in the book about the bullet-riddled airplanes. And the lesson there is what we choose to focus on, right? Or maybe what we focus on without knowing we're focusing on it and not choosing. But tell that story about
So that story, it's actually a famous story. It gets used more as a meme now. And if you see a picture of an old airplane with a bunch of red dots on it online, it's usually posted to kind of show off in a way. It's like, I know something you don't know. You're missing some point. And the point that you're missing, here's the story. So back in World War II, these bombers that were used extensively in the European part of the war came under heavy anti-aircraft fire and flak when they went on these missions. They'd fly in formation over very long distances, drop huge amounts of ordnance, but they took a tremendous amount of damage. Right? And the question was, is there anything you could do to have fewer of these planes get destroyed? Right? And so the Air Force has brought in a statistician and gave him all of the data. He's like, here are all these planes and how they were damaged, and we're going to show you all the damage on these planes. Took all that data, tallied it up, did some fairly sophisticated analyses that are now still used in a lot of economics and other sorts of sciences. This guy named Abraham Wald. And what he concluded was that the damage to the planes wasn't random, right? It was more systematic. Some parts of the planes were hit more than you'd expect given the size of that part of the plane, right? That's a good thing, right? Because it means if there's damage that's systematic, maybe you can reinforce parts of the planes, right? And maybe you can do some help. So
armor plating or whatever.
Exactly. Make it all out of that black box material that seems to survive crashes. But you couldn't add up too much. You couldn't just steel plate the entire plane because then it would be too heavy to fly the long distances. It couldn't carry as much. It would need more fuel. All of those things would counteract it. So, but if the damage is not random, if it's systematic, then maybe there are parts of the planes you could reinforce and increase the chances they'd survive. So the intuitive answer to this is, oh, okay, well, let's look at those parts of the planes that were really heavily damaged and we can reinforce them. And that's exactly the wrong thing to do. Because if those parts of the planes were damaged more on the planes that survived, that means those parts of the planes were less critical to the plane's survival. They could get damaged a lot and still have the plane come back and land. So what we're not thinking about in that case is all of the planes that never came back, where were they damaged? That's the information we need. And we tend to focus on the information we have right in front of us, not the information that's missing. And here's that's a kind of an amazing sort of example of how we can reason incorrectly about this, but we do this all the time. So if you ever read a business book about, a business that was tremendously successful. And let's take an analysis. Let's take a look and see, what did they do in their past that maybe made them successful, right? And what is that?
Good to great leadership examples of the Navy SEALs.
Exactly. Yes,
bookshelves full of these.
Yeah, yes. I mean, probably half the books in the business section are exactly that. You know, here's a leadership success story. Let's look at what they did and then follow their advice. And the problem with that, of course, is in order to know whether that what that person did was at all relevant to their success, we need to know how many people did that and succeeded. But we also need to know how many people did that and failed miserably. And then we also need to know how many people did other things and succeeded and did other things and failed to know whether what that person did had any relationship at all to whether or not they were successful. And it might well be that companies, you know, that it goes the other way around, right? So, you know, maybe Google has some great practices that make their employees very happy, but maybe they're only successful because they're Google, right? And they already have that success and they already have those resources. So looking at what Google does to make their employees happy might not be a recipe for what you should do at your own company, because it might be that they're doing those things because they're Google, not they're Google because they did those things. So thinking about the information we don't have, right? The planes that didn't come back, right? The people who tried that strategy and failed miserably, even realizing that you need to think about those things can take you a long way toward recognizing when you're kind of getting a story instead of evidence.
I think you're hurting our chances for a foosball table and a sushi bar in the Illinois Public Media newsroom. So be it. Okay, let me reintroduce my guest. We are speaking with Daniel Simons, who is the co-author, along with Christopher Chabris, of the new book, Nobody's Fool, Why We Get Taken In and What We Can Do About It. Simons is professor of psychology at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, where he heads the Visual Cognition Laboratory. I first spoke with Simons back in July. We're revisiting that conversation today because at the end of this week, Simons will be giving the Lanier Lecture, 4 p.m. Friday in Urbana on the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign campus. We'll have more information about that on our website, 21stshow.org. More to come after a short break. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Let's continue listening back to my conversation, first recorded in July, with Daniel Simons. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and more to the point for our conversation, he is the co-author with Christopher Chabris of the new book called Nobody's Fool, Why We Get Taken In and What We Can Do About It. Because we taped this conversation, we're not taking calls today, but we do love hearing what you thought, so email us anytime, talk@21stshow.org. So with where we focus being a problem, the solution for that particular issue, for that habit of thought, expanding or breaking our habit of thought and coming up with a better habit of thought maybe, is to use a possibility grid.
Yeah.
As best as we can on radio, and I'm impressed. You do it in text in the book, so I think we can do it here on the radio, even though it's a somewhat visual thing. What is a possibility grid?
I mean, it's basically the set of possibilities that I just described to you, right? So the success leadership book, the one that talks about this great success story and only the success stories, that's just one box in a 2x2 grid, right? It's they tried these leadership strategies and they were successful, right? Or they predicted that these stocks would do great, and they did, right? But there's also the cases where they tried those strategies and they failed, which is a different box in the grid. Or they predicted this stock and it was a dud and it collapsed and you lost all your money, right? Then there are also the grids where they didn't try that leadership strategy, or they tried some other strategy and they succeeded. That's yet another box. And then the last one is the one that's almost impossible to tally up all the numbers for. They didn't try that strategy. They didn't predict that stock. And it didn't succeed, right? That's going to be the vast majority of strategies, the vast majority of stocks. So the key is we tend to focus on the evidence we have, which almost always is going to be that first grid, the box where you tried something and it was successful. You picked a stock and it did well. Those are the ones that you're going to see in marketing, right? You're going to see the advertisement say, this guy picked Tesla 5 years ago and look how successful it was. Here's his next pick, right? Well, what else did he pick that he didn't succeed with, right? I mean, presumably if he said he picked Tesla, that means maybe he didn't pick Google or Apple, right? Which also were very successful. Or maybe he predicted, you know, pets.com years ago and that crashed and burned, but you never get told about those. Right. So we tend to have information in front of us that's just the information that's a success story. It's like you only hear about the psychic predictions that came true, not the ones that failed.
Yeah. I was thinking about this because we had a big set of storms come through central Illinois. My wife and I just had a number of our trees trimmed. We had a couple removed around our house, and the storm comes through, no trees fell on our house. We are geniuses because we had the forethought to have this tree work done. But of course, all of our neighbors who didn't have the tree work done also did not have trees fall on their house, fortunately, in our neighborhood. And then, of course, there's no way of testing the areas, you know, where the storm didn't even come through and people did not have. So it's, yes, we tend to think of the success stories.
Yeah, we tend to think of success stories and we tend to draw strong conclusions from them. Even going back to the thing that we talked about at the beginning, the kind of we mentioned before, I think before we went live, about the invisible gorilla, right? That gorilla study. Most of you might have heard of this. If people are passing basketballs, you're counting how many times players wearing white pass a ball, and a person in a gorilla suit goes through the middle of the video, and about half the people don't see it, right? The people who see it can't believe anybody would miss it, right? Because it's obvious. The people who miss it don't believe that they've missed anything, right? And if you go through life never knowing that you've missed anything, you'll continue to believe you'll see everything, right? You're only aware of those things you happened to have noticed, not the things that you missed. And that applies to pretty much everything we do. We tend to pay attention to those things we've noticed and build up our intuitions about what we see and what's out there from that, and not think, just taking a pause for a second saying, am I missing anything? Could anything else have happened here? Just that extra question can often make you realize, hey, I need to think about those other boxes in that possibility grid when I'm hearing a story that sounds really impressive. So somebody says, hey, Hush Puppies marketed to, you know, trendsetters or influencers, and they took off. It's like, okay, well, how many companies tried that and failed? How many companies tried other things and were more successful? How many companies didn't try either of those things and didn't succeed? We don't know. Right? But you have to know in order to know whether it mattered at all.
I will tell listeners, we will put a link to, or maybe even embed the monkey business, the gorilla basketball video on our website. I won't spoil the rest of it, but I totally fell victim to everything else, even though I knew the gorilla was coming. So as I'm sure
on my YouTube channel, you can find it there.
Most people do. Let's talk about, so those are some of the habits of thought. There are more habits of thought in the book, but then you also write about these hooks, right? I describe them as candy colored ideas and techniques that really short circuit our critical thinking. I was really interested in the one on precision. I've been thinking a lot about this as I've been experimenting with ChatGPT in recent months. It has, I thought, well, maybe this is a tool that can help me prepare for interviews, come up with good questions. So there was an author I was interviewing a couple months ago, and I sort of asked GPT, you know, I gave it a web link to a review of the book and said, you know, what's this about? Summarize it for me, blah, 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 come up with some questions. It completely invented one of the main themes of the book, but it was really convincing about it. So talk about this precision hook and how that ensnares us.
ChatGPT and these large language models are a really interesting thing because they speak with absolute certainty, but they actually have no grounding in truth or reality at all. All they're doing is predictive text, right? They're predicting what's likely to come next based on their very large database that they've learned. But there's no grounding, right? There's no there. They're not making reference to the world. They're not making reference to that book that the author wrote, unless it happens to be in their database. All it's doing is predicting what the most likely thing is given the prompts that it was given, right? And what that means is it will speak in incredibly concrete terms. And I mean, sometimes it's vague, but if you prompt it right, you can get really definitive, straight answers that are completely nonsensical, right? And have no grounding in reality. A lot of the time it does quite well, which is what makes it dangerous, right? That it can give you a lot of details sometimes, and it actually can be spot on in many cases.
It did a good job summarizing your background of your research through 2021. Yeah.
Which is not bad, not surprising, because it's probably trolled my website and other biographies that are out there and other details that have been written, right? So it had information that it could use to predict the most likely thing to say about my record, given my record, if it knows that already. But the real trick for most of us is that unless you really carefully evaluate everything it tells you, the things that it says that it's completely making up are going to sound just as convincing as the things that are true. And it doesn't distinguish. It doesn't care. There's no sentience there that's evaluating, is this true or not? It's just spitting out the next most likely thing to come out. So precision is, we call this a hook, because the vast majority of the time, precision is a great thing, right? That we can use really well, but we find it really appealing. So the idea of precision is that when you have a good understanding of the world, right, you're going to be able to make concrete, specific, precise, detailed claims, right? If you have a good model of physics, you're going to be able to make predictions to six decimal places, right? And that precision is meaningful in that context. The more precision you have, the better understanding you have, the more precision you'll have. The danger comes when we try and make the opposite inference. We assume that when you see something that's precise, that it must correspond to something that's really well grounded or really well understood. And people looking to deceive us or to market to us, if they're being kind of malicious about it, or just convince us of something, will tend to spout really precise numbers because we associate precision with understanding. So when a business guru tells you that, you know, 16.5% of customers are early adopters of new technology, I'm like, okay, well, that's a really precise number. How do you know it's not 16.4? Or 16.6, right?
Right?
How many people did you actually measure to do that? And more often than not, it's nonsense, right? There's one that's going around right now that we actually looked it up. We ran across this 2 days ago, which was that the optimal rate for a failure when you're trying to learn something or try and succeed is 15.87% of the time, right? Which is a really precise number. And you know, yeah, of course, sometimes if you're trying to learn some new skill, it makes sense that you're not always going to learn best if you always succeed. You have to have some failures and learn from them. But if you have 100% failures, you're probably not going to do very well, and you're probably not going to learn too much. So it makes sense that there'd be some failures and some successes would give you some sort of best learning. But this was a number that actually came from a computational model where you had computer algorithms trying to classify things. So is this a dog or a cat? Right. And how many failures does it need to optimally perform? And this was kind of a model of what the optimal was for neural network models. It had nothing to do with people at all, but it's being framed as, hey, here's the optimal rate for success. Right. So as soon as you see a number that precise, you can think to yourself, okay, how could you get to that? How many people would you have to measure to know that it was 15.87 and not 15.86? And how many types of learning would you have to measure to know that it was that? Right. And the answer is way more than we would ever do in reality. So if we find that really compelling, that somebody gives you that really precise number, well, then you're probably being misled to some extent, because at least in when it comes to human behavior, we don't tend to measure things that precisely. We don't tend to have that level of measurement skill, measurement precision. We're not measuring physics, you know, we're not measuring, you know, something that's a constant in physics to some incredible level of precision. We don't have the tools to do that when you're talking about human behavior or thinking or the mind.
And you document some real world dangers from this too, as well as, I should say, you document some real world dangers with this, such as early predictions from the United States government or the Trump administration about COVID deaths and what was going to happen there. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about cubism?
Yeah. So this was a, I mean, it was almost laughable, right? That it was a this was a question of what was going to happen in terms of the death rate. This was in the very early days, spring of 2020, before we had a tremendous amount of information. There'd been a handful of deaths, you know, at very low rate. And what the Trump administration did was predicted that several weeks out there would be the rates would fall to zero, right? There'd be no deaths, right? And of course, there were a lot of deaths. Well, what did they do? They had an economist who was not an expert in infectious disease at all, fit a bunch of models in Excel and tried to account for the current rate of death and changes in the rate of death, and then applied various sort of models to fit to those data to try and predict what would happen into the future. And when you do that, depending on the model you choose and the parameters you choose, you can either have the number go way up or way down. They chose what's called a cubic model. So a model that goes up, then down, then up again, or vice versa. So depending on how you treat the basically flat line of almost no deaths from day to day at the very beginning of the pandemic, the direction you treat that as going completely changes what your prediction is 4 weeks out, right? So it was a nonsensical model. It was way too precise a model given the very limited data that we had. And we've had lots of cases like this. The U of I had some modeling that turns out to have not been very accurate, in, at least in terms of the public claims about it. The modeling itself was great, right? The modeling itself predicted exactly what happened in the fall of 2020. But it depended on which assumptions you started with. And a lot of the assumptions we heard about in the media were not the assumptions that were actually the most valid at the time.
And the real world always gets in the way, right? Undergraduates don't necessarily follow the rules as precisely as they are told to. Yeah.
Well, that's exactly right. And the modeling, if you look at the full modeling, it actually accounted for that. If you said, hey, we're going to not assume 100% compliance, we're going to assume 40% compliance, what would the rates be? Hey, we're not going to assume everybody's going to get their results back instantly and we'll be able to contact trace. Instead, we're going to assume it will take a day sometimes. If you make those assumptions, which are actually what happened, the prediction would have been about 4,000 cases in the fall of 2020, which is exactly what we had. The prediction of 700 was based on an assumption of perfect tracing, perfect compliance, and instant results, right? Which, of course, were predictably not going to happen. It's a difficult task to predict real-world human behavior, right? And whenever you make a really precise claim, you have to look and think about, what are the assumptions that went into that, right? And are those assumptions right? And maybe we should think about the error in that. You know, maybe it's not 15.87. Maybe it's somewhere between 5 and 30%, right? Maybe it's not exactly 700 cases. Maybe it's between, you know, 400 and 4,000. And we don't really know because we don't have enough information.
I want to ask you about the process of writing this book, and we'll come back to some of the big picture conclusions toward the end, maybe. But how does it work? I read a book once by Dan Patrick and Keith Olbermann, who were the hosts of SportsCenter. Mm-hmm. They kind of put that show on the map. And it had this amazing conceit where supposedly, I think it was everything written by Olbermann was in a serif font and everything written by Patrick was in sans serif. So how does that work with a co-author?
Well, Chris Chabris and I have collaborated for decades now, and both on research and on general audience writing and op-eds and books now. This is our second book together. And we both are really good at editing each other's writing. So often what will happen is one of us will draft a section, just write a first draft of a section because we're really interested in that. And then we'll pass it back and forth a dozen times until it gets honed. And sometimes we'll write a section and it turns out that the other of us says, nah, that just doesn't work. It doesn't fit here. And then we just scrap it and put it into our outcuts file. You know, we have different areas of expertise. Chris is a chess master. So he is highly familiar with the chess community and online chess and chess cheating. I'm an average tournament chess player, so I don't have that expertise, but I can edit what he writes. You know, I have a lot more experience dealing with replications in science and science fraud. So I wrote the first drafts of a lot of those sections, but we then pass them back and forth. So there's really, by the time we're finished, we might every now and then be able to recognize, oh yeah, that was one of Chris's phrases, or that was one of mine. But we really have pretty much co-written everything in the book. There are very few things that I don't think there's anything that we didn't both touch at some point and edit pretty heavily. And you know, there are things we disagree on. Chris likes commas and very, very long sentences. I tend not to. And so we're often changing things back and forth until we settle on something. And but yeah, we for the most part, we end up pretty much agreeing on structure. And I think that's partly why, you know, we decided to write another book together, is that the writing part was actually quite a bit of fun. You know, it's we both enjoy the idea of taking sort of a big idea and trying to refine it until we can make it as clear as possible.
All right, we need to take a break. We will continue with U of I psychology professor Dan Simons. His latest book is Nobody's Fool: Why We Get Taken In and What We Can Do About It. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Let's listen now to the conclusion of my conversation from July, recorded with Daniel Simons, a professor of psychology at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and the co-author with Christopher Chabris of the book Nobody's Fool: Why We Get Taken In and What We Can Do About It. Simons is going to be giving the Lanier Lecture in Psychology. That is this Friday, 4 p.m., on the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign campus. If you happen to be in town and want to go to that, we'll have more information on our website, 21stshow.org. You mentioned the replication crisis in science, mm-hmm. and that's something you've given a lot of thought and effort to over the years. Maybe for listeners who aren't familiar with that, just briefly, particularly in psychology, what is the replication crisis?
So the replication crisis is I think of it less as a crisis anymore at this point, but it is. I view it more as a credibility crisis. What do we need to do to make our science more trustworthy, more believable? And a lot of the changes and reforms that have happened really just in the last 10 to 12 years came out of psychology. Other disciplines are kind of a little bit behind the curve. Psychology kind of had a crisis of conscience about a dozen years ago, when a whole number of things happened at once. Several prominent findings that were really well established ended up not holding up. A paper that was published claimed to be that people could predict the future of random events, right? Predict which of two sides of a display was going to show an image before it actually happened. So essentially a form of psychic ability. It was published in the leading journal in social psychology by a very prominent figure, and used all of the standard procedures in the field for statistical analysis. And there are two ways to take that. One is he provided compelling evidence, which the vast majority of people in the field said, no, that can't be right, right? The finding can't be right. Well, if the finding wasn't right, then there must be something wrong with the practices that allowed him to find that, right? So it led to a reevaluation of sort of the statistical practices, the reporting practices, how we analyze data, how we design studies to be able to analyze data effectively, and how we document, right? So when we have a hypothesis about a study, how do we lay that out in advance? So pre-registering or specifying what we're going to do and how we're going to do it and what we're going to conclude depending on the different outcomes in advance is a way of counteracting some of the sort of problems in the field. So there were a number of things, along with several prominent cases of fraud that happened at the same moment. And that's really a different problem. Outright fraud is something we talk about a lot in our book, but fraud is a really different problem than the reproducibility crisis. Most of the cases that we're dealing with in that failure to replicate prominent findings was that the methods and the analyses were not rigorous in the ways that we need them to be, or they were not reported completely, or only the successful ones ended up in the published literature and we don't know about all the failures. It's a case of focus, right? We only see what's in the published literature. We don't know how many times they tried the same thing and it didn't work.
Has that gotten better? Can people publish hypotheses that are not borne out by the experiments now?
It's getting better, and partly because there have been a couple of reforms in the publishing world that are really a radical change. And it's kind of odd that they're a radical change because it's how most of us envision science actually happening, right? You generate a hypothesis, say what you're going to do, and then regardless of how it comes out, you report it, right? That's kind of what we think of as science. That's how doctoral theses work, right? You tell your committee, here's my plan. Your committee evaluates it. They form changes to it. They make it work. Then you go and collect your data, and that's your dissertation, right? Regardless of what ends up coming out of it. Well, that's how science should work. And if you're designing a study that's well-designed to test a critical question, you want the evidence out there regardless of how it comes out. So there's a format called a registered report now, where the review process, the critical review process, happens before data collection. Right? And you specify what you're going to do, you specify how you're going to do it, how the data are going to be analyzed, how everything's going to be coded, then you go do it. And you're basically guaranteed that the paper will be published as long as it's a well-designed study. Right. And there are other ways around this too, right? There are ways of eliminating bias that physicists have long used, right? One is to blind the people who are doing the analysis to the conditions. So you write your analysis code not knowing which data are from which condition. And it might even be randomized for you.
Maybe you can make that a little more concrete for people. Like, yeah. What would that look like in an actual
sure.
experiment?
Sure. So imagine a simple case like a medical trial where you've got an experiment group and a placebo group, somebody who's getting a fake drug, right? And you want to see, does this new treatment improve your health better, more than the sugar pill does, right? The placebo does. Well, let's say that if you pre-registered everything and specified what you were going to do, then regardless of how that comes out, you need to know the outcome, right? It helps to know whether the treatment doesn't work, and it helps to know if it does, and it helps to know how much it worked. But let's say that you didn't do that. Well, if you know what the outcome should be, right, you know what the outcome is that you're hoping for, there are all sorts of subtle statistical tricks you can use to kind of make it come out the way that you want it to by selectively deleting data, that sort of thing. Well, one way you can help yourself avoid that problem is to have the person who writes all your analysis code, tells you how to do the statistics, not know which people were in the placebo group and which people were in the control group. So you take the data and just randomly call this one a placebo, this one a control, regardless of where they actually were. So you get all of the data structure, right? You get all of the numbers and things, but you don't know whether they were in the treatment group or the control group. So when you write your analysis, the outcomes of that analysis on the random data don't tell you anything. But once you've written your code, then you plug in the real data with the analyses that everybody's kind of decided these are good analyses, and then whatever the outcome is the outcome, right? So it's a way of keeping yourself from biasing the data. We're all human, right? We all kind of want to see outcomes come out some way or another. And anything you can do to kind of take away those sort of subtle things that we might not even realize we're doing when we're looking at something, right? You don't want to bias the observations. So anything you can do to kind of get rid of those sort of underlying biases that we might not even think about from the process helps. So that's been a big part of the reform effort. Far too many really prominent textbook level, intro psych level textbook findings just don't hold up. They're just not true, right? And that's something that we've kind of come to realize over the past, you know, 12 years or so.
Can we talk about the marshmallow test? Like, where is that today? I feel like I've read the backlash pieces, and then there were backlash to the backlash, and it's like, well, maybe... You know,
it's not one that I've actually followed
sure.
all that closely.
Okay.
There are a lot of other ones that are kind of related to that. So one of the big ones that I was involved in kind of loosely as the editor of a journal is a phenomenon known as ego depletion, which is related, right? It's the idea that if you do something that's sort of personally demanding, that's hard on you, right, that's draining. Right. And then you have less resources left over for something else. And
willpower. This is the idea.
Essentially willpower. Yeah. But it's like the marshmallow thing in that you're kind of withholding, you know, it's how well can you inhibit yourself? But this is more if you do something that's draining, right? Does it drain you cognitively too? Right. And at some level, it's kind of obvious, right? If you do something and you get tired, you're going to be tired and not do as well. Right. But it's not about just fatigue. The idea was that it's really things that are kind of a threat to your identity in some way are draining and make it harder to do a task after that. And we had a study that like was done by a whole bunch of proponents of this idea, right? They wanted to shore it up and kind of see, okay, can we get this if we pre-register it? If we specify everything we're going to do in advance, if we do it like a registered report so that there's no possibility of selective reporting or selective analysis. So a whole bunch of labs all over the world, mostly people who are firm believers in this and had done published many papers in the topic, they selected a procedure to use from a relatively recent paper that got big effects. And they all went off and did the same study, same design, same procedures, same materials all over the world. And we then combined all of those results to see what's the effect. And the answer was essentially zero, right? It just didn't hold up. And that's been true for a number of other things. That led to a big replication attempt by other proponents of this theory, also following very good practices with analyses that were largely blinded. And the end result was, again, a tiny, tiny little effect when most of the studies that had been published on this were gigantic effects that you just could see with your naked eyes. Like, this is a huge effect. But the observed effect is one that was so small that none of the published studies in the literature would have been able to find it reliably. They were all too small. You would need about 10,000 people in a study to find this effect at all reliably, right? It was that small. So that's an example of something that was really prominent, hundreds of papers. And as you know, at least the ones, the variants of it that have been tested, if it's there, it's tiny.
Yeah.
And you know, that happens whenever you've got a field that, you know, doesn't publish the failed results, right? Doesn't publish the negative findings. You need to kind of accumulate knowledge over time. And that's actually what most of the reformers are aiming for, is just making it possible to have knowledge accumulate without selectively just publishing the flashy things that work.
Coming back to the book, and our time together is coming to an end soon, Nobody's Fool, you talk about ways that we make ourselves sort of visible to potential scammers, right? And this is one of the things that we can do rather than just becoming skeptical of everything all the time, right? What's that? Was it Marx who said, De omnibus disputandum, of all things be skeptical?
Yeah.
If we're not going to take... Yeah. Right. That's no way to live.
Yeah.
So what do we do?
Yeah. I mean, I think the key is finding that middle ground where we think about the times when being deceived would be really consequential. So let's say you're figuring out when you're going to retire, or what you're going to do with your retirement, who you're going to invest your savings with, or who you're going to date, things that might matter to you in the long haul. You know, should I buy a house or not? Should I rent an apartment? Which approach should I take, under which conditions? Those are the times when you're most likely to be at risk, because there's large costs involved and there are potential consequences. Making a big business decision, starting a new business, is it the right decision to make? Those sorts of moments are the times when we really should be thinking critically. And the problem is, when we're hopeful, right? When we're hoping to, you know, score big, or when we're afraid, you know, we're afraid that if we don't take action right now, something's bad's going to happen. Those are the times when we're most vulnerable to being scammed. And scammers are really, really good at taking advantage of those fears and hopes. So if you're the sort of person who thinks, I really need to, you know, I'm living day to day on Social Security, I really need to get some big, you know, big score so that I can kind of live more comfortably as I age, that's a target population. Or let's say you're a recent widow or widower, right? You're a natural target for romance scammers. And the information about us is so public, for the most part, that they can target specifically the people who are most at risk. In our community, we've had a number of international students who've been targeted by scammers, right? And this has been, you know, a big deal, right? People have been taken for tens of thousands of dollars. More often than not, those are a variant of what's known as a call center scam. And what they will do is call up people who have uncertain immigration status. You know, they have a visa, they might lose their visa if they don't go back at the right time. There's a fear of being deported. There's a fear you might have made some mistake in filling out your documentation to get here. They'll call up and threaten that unless you pay up, the police are going to come right now and deport you. And if you are in an uncertain situation and the scammer is very effective, which they typically are, they can easily rope people into sending them money, often through electronic cash payments. The most common form is a cash card, prepaid cash cards. If anybody ever asks you to pay for something with a prepaid cash card, and no government organization, no company is ever going to do that. It's always a scam. And there's almost never, it's very rare that there's a case of what we call an exploding offer, something that has to happen right now or it goes away, right? The police are going to come if you don't pay right now, or if you don't buy this thing right now, you'll never have another opportunity. 99% of the time, and that's overly precise, but the vast majority of the time, that's a scam. It's not necessary. We almost never have to make that kind of a decision under that kind of pressure.
Stop and think. I think that's the big message I'm taking away. Well, take that pause.
And if it's exactly what you were waiting for, and you get a message by text, why would they reach out to you? Why you?
Yeah.
You know, are you the only one they've reached out to? And as soon as you start thinking about that, it's like, okay, did they send this to a ton of people? And if they send it to a ton of people am I really the right person to be investing in crypto right now?
That big break is just around the corner. I know it.
Yeah.
Daniel.
Everybody hopes.
Yeah. Right? Daniel Simons, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
My pleasure.
Daniel Simons is a professor of psychology at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and the co-author, along with Christopher Chabris, of the new book, Nobody's Fool, Why We Get Taken In and What We Can Do About It. Simons is going to be giving a talk about many of these same topics this Friday, 4 p.m., in the campus instructional facility in Urbana, Illinois, at the University of Illinois. If you want more information on that, visit our website, 21stshow.org. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. I'll talk with you again tomorrow.